My son stood sobbing and shivering as gleeful children shouted and splashed all around us. We were at a water park, and we had ascended to the apex of the largest water slide there, which was no small feat, just getting to the top. Series of ladders and ramps and people waiting. And here we were, the moment of anticipation. We were next. And I looked at my son, and I realized that something was wrong. He was not excited. In fact, his face showed me the opposite of excitement. He was terrified. He was paralyzed with fear. And so as the teenaged worker motioned for us to come and take our seat on the mat, and I grabbed his hand and I pulled, and I realized that he wasn't moving. He had taken his other hand and he had grabbed onto the rail. And there he stood. And there the battle began. Between me and my voice versus him and what he saw, which was, I don't know what, a tunnel of rapids that was about to plunge him to his death. And so here I am reassuring him, son, I would never ask you to do something that would hurt you. Look at all these kids having fun. Look at all these smiling faces. Look at all these enthusiasts at the water park. Come on, let's do this. Man up. Come on, face your fear. I lost that battle that day. For those very ladders and ramps that we had ascended, we had to descend. And it's not fun going down that way. I can tell you that right now. We went down the wrong way. But even though I lost that battle, I won the war. You see, we went to our hotel room that night, and we talked about it all night long. And you know what we did first thing the very next morning? Yeah, that's right. We conquered that water slide. Just needed a little coaxing, a little reassurance, needed a little time. But I tell you that story because that scene represents for me a battle that we are all familiar with. In fact, it's a battle that we've seen playing out in Ecclesiastes, a battle revolving around the question, what is really real? What is really true? You see, we live in this life under the sun, and we live in this world where we can touch things and hear things and smell things and see things and taste things, and the temptation that we have to face and the temptation that we have to battle is the one where what we see and what we feel and what we touch, we tend to think that this is all that there is. And the question that we have to ask ourselves and the question that Ecclesiastes is helping us answer is there more? Is this all that there is? Is life under the sun the only reality? Sometimes listening for the voice of God feels like you're trying to listen to someone whisper at a rock concert, right? It doesn't sound very loud. It feels hidden. In contrast to our smartphones, in contrast to all the things going on around us, all the activity, all the busyness, all of the things that we're pursuing in our lives, you wake up and sometimes you feel like you never have time to slow down. And the temptation that we have is to wonder, is God really there at all? Where is He? And so I ask you, do you ever feel the burden of that battle? Do you ever experience that? Do you ever feel like God's voice is being drowned out by the world in front of you? Like you hardly have time to slow down and listen because of all these things in front of your sight, in front of your eyes. I confess to you this morning that as a pastor, I struggle with that. right? Someone who makes my living, my calling, is to read the Bible and to study the Bible and to pray and to pursue ministry. And yet even I struggle deeply with this battle, and so I know that we all struggle here. This is where we are. This is the air that we breathe. This is the life that we live, and the preacher has wisdom for us if you experience that battle yourself. And the first thing that he tells us in verses 1 through 7 is he says, learn to use your ears more than your mouth. Now, this is really hard for some of us. But this is the advice. This is the wisdom. He says, if you're going to see God, if you're going to discern Him in this world, you must learn to use your ears more than your mouth. Look with me at verse 1. He's urging caution here. He says, guard your steps when you go to the house of God. And so the context for this instruction is worship. When you go to the temple, when you go to the house of God, we would say, when you go to church on Sunday morning, guard your steps. Be careful when you go to the house of God. Why? Why do we have to be careful? Look at what he says next. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. And so he says, listen, here's the warning. You could go to church, you could go to worship, and the only sacrifice you're offering, he says, is the sacrifice of fools. And he calls this evil. So we wonder, well, what exactly is he critiquing? We know that this is often an issue in the Bible, what he's talking about here. In fact, in Isaiah chapter 29, verse 13, through the prophet Isaiah, God brings judgment upon his people. And the reason for that judgment in Isaiah 29, 13 is their people draw near with their mouth and honor me with their lips while their hearts are far from me, he says. They draw near me with their mouths. They honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. This is what's being warned against in Ecclesiastes 5:1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. This is a warning against just going through the motions. You ever done that? You ever found yourself in your life just going through the motions? You get up on Sunday morning, why? Because you always get up on Sunday morning. You get in your car and you drive to church, why? Because you always get in your car and drive to church on Sunday morning. And our life can become this series of activities completely devoid of any meaning or significance. This is what he's talking about. Periods of our life can so often become devoid of worship. And at the end of the day, we're just on autopilot. And when we look for God, he's really not anywhere to be found. And the preacher in Ecclesiastes is warning us against that. He says that is dangerous. He says, do not do that. He says, you are a fool if that is the life that you're living. That is not the wise life. This type of sacrifice does not honor God. When you just draw near with your mouths and your lips, when you just speak religious language, when you just participate in religious activity, but your heart is far from Him, you're not truly devoted to Him, you're not fooling Him. He says this is evil. He says this is the sacrifice of fools. He continues in verses 2 and 3. He says, be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. And so here he's critiquing presumption, particularly the way we speak. the way that we constantly want to say things before we hear things. We want to utter things before we really know what we're saying. For God is in heaven, he says, and you are on earth. So this is a reminder to us of our position. He is the exalted one. He is the one who knows all things. We are limited. We are created. Here we are on this earth. Don't pretend like you are higher than you are, but remember your station before you speak. Therefore, let your words be few. Verse 3, for a dream comes with much business and a fool's voice with many words. This is simply a comparison he's making. It's kind of hard to understand. He says a dream comes with much business. So someone who's conducting a lot of business is a daydreamer. Someone who's often thinking about the future. That's the word that's used here. And he says, just like business leads to dreams, a fool's voice are many words. A fool will lead to many words. And so someone who is foolish will be someone who talks a lot. That's the comparison that he's making. He's simply making a connection between someone who lives not as a wise person, but someone who lives as a fool. That's going to be somebody who talks a lot. They don't really know what they're talking about. And then in verses 4 through 7, he's going to go through this long section about vows. When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. And I don't think we really understand what this means. We talk about vows, and we don't really think like this much today. But let me give you an illustration of what he's talking about. I remember before I finally gave my life to Jesus when I was 20, there were lots of times where I tried to make a deal with God. Have you ever done that? There were lots of times where I would say, God, if you will whatever, I promise I'll be at church on Sunday. I promise I will live for you then, right? And so here I would be hungover, drunk, hugging a toilet, miserable. God, if you will just get me through this time, I'll wake up tomorrow. On Sunday morning, I'll be at church. How good do you think I was on paying those vows? No. But there was mercy for me. And there's mercy for you. And there's mercy for the person being critiqued here. But it's still a warning. He says, this is a foolish way to live. When you vow a vow to God, do not delay paying it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you vow. If you tell God you're going to do something, do it. It is better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. In the New Testament, Jesus warns against making vows at all. Why? Because we are to be a people who simply tell the truth. And if we're a people who tell the truth, why would we need to vow? Right? If we're a people who have a habit in our speech of saying what we're going to do, vows are unnecessary. Let not your mouth lead you into sin, and do not say before the messenger that it was a mistake. The messenger comes, and we're using presumption with our mouth again, and so we are arguing with the messenger. He says that is foolish. Again, he is warning against the use of our tongue, the use of our words. Why should God be angry at your voice and destroy the work of your hands? For when dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. And here's the issue. When we use words foolishly, we are not fearing God. We are not worshiping God. But when we submit our tongues to God, we fear him, we worship him, we exalt him. And the issue in this entire section goes all the way back to chapter 5, verse 1. Look up here with me again. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools. I want to camp out here for just a moment. See, this is what he's talking about. True worship begins with listening. You cannot worship God if you do not listen. This is the first step. But the problem that you and I have is that we often don't like to listen. Have you ever experienced the revulsion of having to listen to advice from someone that you don't think knows what they're talking about? Have you ever experienced that? Come on. I had this just last week. I can't give you too many details because I don't know who listens to these sermons. But someone was trying to tell me something about a topic that I knew more than them about, and yet I was in a position where I had to listen to them, and I hated it. And I thought, as I'm studying Ecclesiastes chapter 5, why? Why am I feeling this revulsion right now? You know why? It's five letters. P-R-I-D-E. Pride. That's why. You know why we don't listen? The reason we don't listen is because we're prideful people. The reason why we don't listen is because we have an inflated ego. Because we think that we're above listening. This is the problem. This, he says, is foolish. We are proud, and listening requires humility. Listening requires the admission that we don't often know what we're talking about. But when we fear God, we are admitting that He knows what He's talking about. And when we admit that He knows what He's talking about, we are willing to humble ourselves and worship and listen to Him. And so we go to the house of God in 5:1, and we draw near to listen to Him. You ever considered that maybe the reason why you struggle to, for example, pay attention to Sunday sermons has nothing to do with who's speaking? Have you ever considered that maybe the reason you struggle to pay attention to Sunday sermons is because there's pride in your heart and you don't want to listen? That's what the implication of this means. Often our pride blocks us from hearing the voice of God in the world. How does God speak? He speaks through His Word. From the very beginning, God has spoken to His people. We have a God who speaks. And so if we are going to be Christians, if we are going to follow Christ in this world, and we have a God who speaks, what does that say about us? It says that we are to be a people who listen. This is to be the habit of our lives, to be listening for His voice. From the very beginning, this is the way it was. Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 through 9, this famous passage of God telling His people how they are to respond to Him. And this is what we find. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. And these words that I command you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house and when you walk by the way and when you lie down and when you rise. You shall bind them as a sign on your hand and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorpost of your house and on your gates. The posture of God's people are that we are to be listening to Him. This command begins with the call to hear. And then He tells us that we're to love the Lord our God with all of our being. And then He tells us how that love is to be expressed by surrounding ourselves with reminders of His Word. By listening. By writing His words. By meditating on His words. By cultivating habits of listening in our lives. And this isn't just an Old Testament thing. If you're the kind of person that likes to draw a distinction between the Old Testament and the New Testament, we don't do that here. But if you do, even in the New Testament, John 10:27, Jesus says, "My sheep hear my voice, and I know them, and they follow me." That is an ongoing hearing of His voice. He is the shepherd, and His sheep are those who are continually listening, hearing His voice, and following Him. This is what the Bible says. We hear His voice through Scripture. And so what's going on here? The preacher in Ecclesiastes is telling us, church, that the pathway to joy in this life under the sun is to cultivate the habit of listening to the voice of God. And let me tell you why it's so important that we do this. Because if you don't listen to the voice of God, you will listen to other voices. You understand that? You're a listening people. We are listening people. We listen by nature. That's who we are. And so there is a void there. And if you're not listening to the voice of God, you are going to fill that void with other voices, and you are going to listen to other voices instead. And the voice that you habitually listen to will be the voice that determines the flow and the direction of your life. My sister has been in North Carolina for like the past 15 years, and she just moved back to Alabama last year, and I just talked to her on the phone. And you know what I noticed when I talked to her on the phone 2 days ago? That glorious, thick Alabama accent has returned. It's back. She went to North Carolina and they tried to change her, and then she went back home and it's like, yes! It's back! That's my sister. Now, why does that happen? Why does that happen? Well, because she's now surrounded by people who talk the right way. And when she is surrounded by people who talk the right way, what's that going to do to her? That has a shaping impact on her life. She now talks the right way. She's moved away. And y'all say, well, North Carolina's not Yankees and up there where Dan's from. It's not. But it's not close enough to the right spot where people know how to talk. A couple of years ago, one of our daughters, we began to notice a new tone. It wasn't a pleasant tone. We began to notice that there was a new kind of sassy, I know what I'm talking about, I'm on your level, Dad, kind of tone. And I was like, where is this coming from? You know, and with my theology and knowing the Bible, we know that it doesn't have to come from anywhere. It's coming right from her heart. But we also began to notice a connection between every time she would spend time with one of her friends, this tone would increase. And so we started putting it all together. Like, every time she goes and plays over here, she comes home and we deal with this. And so we began to realize that she's spending time with someone who's clearly showing this tone in her home, and she's picking up on this. She's listening to that voice, and it is determining her voice. You see how this works? See, what voice is dominating your life? See, this is the question you have to ask. And it gets real practical. You know, who are you spending the most time around? Which voice are you giving your ear to the most? That's going to determine the way you think about the world. You and I have to cultivate habits and behaviors that cause our ears to have a resonance with the voice of God and not the voice of Satan, which comes in so many different forms. The voice of Satan that utters nothing but lies to tell you that your identity is found and cultivated by your own performance. That tells you that the way to make it in the world is to try to look like the people out there in the world. To try to make your life match. To try to make you live up to a certain status. That is the voice of Satan, and the voice of God is constantly calling us back to the gospel. And so how do we apply this? Well, you're going to apply this privately, I would hope. Privately, what habits and disciplines are you cultivating to make the voice of God the prominent voice in your life? Are you giving your ear to His voice daily? It's important. Fathers, let me speak to you. How are you leading your family to recognize the voice of God? Your small children, are you making time to show them that the voice of God is more important than the voice of Netflix. It's more important than the voice of whatever other voice is filtering into your home. This voice must be prominent. Are you sitting your family down and opening His Word consistently? Summertime's a hard time because all consistency and routine kind of gets tossed out the window. And so we kind of have to work harder in my house in the summer. And sometimes I do a better job than others. But this is a priority that we have to cultivate. And then finally, the fact that you're here today is great, right? We are to cultivate habits of gathering together and worshiping together as the people of God, hearing God's Word together. This is what we do Sunday after Sunday. But let me stop for just a moment, because if we don't say this, we miss the whole point of these verses. It doesn't just matter that you show up. How you show up is so important to understanding what this verse is about. Are you spending time to get your heart ready? Are you spending time thinking about how to worship, how to listen to a sermon, how to make sure that I'm focused on Christ, reminding myself that I am here for Him, that I am here to worship Him, that I'm not just hoping I get to sing a familiar song this morning, but I'm actually worshiping through the lyrics that I'm singing? Do you see the difference? You see, we have to be listeners before we are ever able to be speakers. We have to use our ears more than our mouths. But he goes on, and the second thing, piece of advice he's going to give us in these verses is that we have to learn to see with different eyes. Look with me at verse 8. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. He returns to a familiar topic here. We've already seen this previously in Ecclesiastes. He's looking out at the world and he sees oppression. He sees that the poor are being trampled on, that there is a system where the poor are not being cared for. Violation of justice and righteousness. He says, do not be amazed at the matter. In other words, you should expect this in this fallen world under the sun that we live in. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. And so here's the point that he's making. When you get into these hierarchies, often no one's thinking about anyone down here. The person at this level is simply using the people at the level under them to get what they want. And the people at this level are using the people under them to get what they want. And the people at this level are using the people at this level to get what they want. And in a hierarchy like this, the people at the bottom are those who are being trampled on. They are being oppressed. In verse 9, he says, but this is a gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivated fields. Cultivated fields in the Old Testament meant that the poor are being cared for, that there were laws and regulations in how you cultivate your fields because you were supposed to make sure that those who are at the very bottom are getting enough to live and they're not being oppressed. He bridges this into a different conversation, but it's still related. And by the way, I'll remind you that the topic here is still worship, and we'll see that here in verse 10. Because this is what drives the oppression in verse 8. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. We've talked about this a lot the past few weeks. Those who love money and they pursue money as their chief end, accumulating more and more and more, they're never satisfied. This is vanity. Verse 11, when goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? What advantage does it have to keep accumulating these goods so you can just look at them? That's all you get. They don't satisfy you. Verse 12, sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. This contrast between the one who works hard and the rich, who can't even sleep because of his full stomach. This is imagery of foolishness versus wisdom. Verse 13, there is a grievous evil that I have seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is a father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. In other words, he accumulated riches, and then he made an investment, and he lost it all, and he doesn't even have anything to hand down to his own son. Verse 15, as he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again, naked as he came, and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, and much vexation and sickness and anger. Vanity of vanities, right? You return just as you came. You came naked. You will return the same way. You will take nothing with you. This is the vain existence. Now, I told you that he's still talking about worship here, and how do we know that? Because he's using worship language. Look at verse 10. He who loves money, how do you worship? You love. That's what love is. That's love worship. It's the same thing. You worship by loving. You love by worshiping. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. This is worship language again. Satisfaction, to want to have our hearts full, and to think that money somehow can do that. The point that he's making is that worship never stops. You ever thought about that? Listen to me, there is no such thing as a person who doesn't worship. This is a point made all over the Bible. In Romans chapter 1, verses 21 and through 23, Paul argues that rejection of God does not mean rejection of worship, but exchange of worship. When you reject God, you are not ceasing to worship. You are simply substituting God to worship something else. And Paul tells us that what we worship when we substitute God is we are exchanging the invisible for the visible. We want something we can touch. We want something we can hold. We want something we can see. And so we worship images. We worship money. We worship accumulation. We worship the same thing that the people of Israel were worshiping when they were led out of Egypt, right? And they go into the land, and Aaron steps away, and Moses steps away. And what did they demand? Give us something to hold. And they talk Aaron into making a golden calf, and they hold it up, and they look at the golden calf, the thing they can touch, and the thing they can feel, and the thing they can see, and they say, "Behold the God who led us out of Egypt." Because we're not satisfied with the invisible God. We're not satisfied with the God we cannot see. We have to have a God that we can control, a God that we can hold in our hands. This is the issue. Which eyes are you using to worship with? What really captivates you, church? Listen, this is a really important question. Are you more captivated by what you can go to the store and buy? Or are you more captivated with the invisible God that you get to sing about? Right? This is the battle. This is the war. What really makes your heart fire? What really revs you up? This is a searching question. And it's really important because Jesus tells us in Matthew 6:24, you cannot serve God. And that word for serve is another word for worship. You cannot worship God and money. You cannot worship the invisible and at the same time worship the visible. You can't do both. Your heart only has the capacity to worship one thing as ultimate. And so either God is ultimate and money is not ultimate, or money is ultimate and you're making God not ultimate. And he gives us the alternative in verses 18 through 20. See, the wisdom doesn't just stop at telling us what not to do. The preacher wants to leave us with something positive, and so he does that in verse 18. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. He says it's good to enjoy what God has given you in this world. Look at verse 19. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. God gives you wealth. He gives you possessions. He gives you things, and he gives you the power to enjoy them. This is his gift, verse 20. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. God is the giver of joy. He is the one making this vain existence bearable. That's the point that he's making. Now, I find this kind of surprising. This is the alternative, and I want you to notice that the response from the preacher in Ecclesiastes is he doesn't say, oh, because you have this tendency to worship money, quit thinking about it. Money's bad. Money's evil. Don't pursue it. That is not what he says here. That's not the point. That's not the perspective of the Bible. The Bible never says money is evil. The Bible says love of money is evil. You see the difference. But what is prominent in verses 18 through 20, and what was absent in the section that we just looked at, is here you are seeing and recognizing that the giver of money, the giver of gifts, is God. Right? And so money here is not ultimate, God is ultimate. You are not worshiping money as an idol, you are worshiping God. And when we worship God as ultimate, we are free to receive the gifts that He desires for us to have. When God is our greatest source of delight, we are free to enjoy whatever gift He wants to send our way. What He's telling us in these verses is that the eyes of faith, the eyes of our heart, have to have priority over the eyes in our head. We have to fight to see with our heart before we see with our physical eyes. We have to allow faith to control and direct and determine the direction of our lives. The alternative to that is idolatry. Idolatry is simply when we look around us and we see all the things around us not as gifts but as gods. What brings you most joy? That's such a heart-searching question. Don't pass over it. What brings you most joy? Think about that. Because when you get down to the bottom of the answer to that question, behold your God. What brings you most joy is what you're worshiping as ultimate. And if you're worshiping anything but God as ultimate, well, the preacher wants us to know that this is evil, this is foolish, this is not the way to live under the sun. That is a vanity of an existence. The solution to our tendencies toward idolatry is not to reject the things in the world. The solution is to keep God first and to see every enjoyment as a gift from His hand. He is the highest. He brings me the joy. John Calvin once wrote, "In despising His gifts, we insult the giver." We're not supposed to despise His gifts. We are supposed to receive His gifts. I had a friend recently who told me, he said, "I've never heard a pastor talk about sports the way you do." And you know what? My first response was like, am I talking about sports wrongly? And then when I started thinking about what I know about this friend, I came to the conclusion that what he's expressing is that so often pastors make people feel guilty for living in the world. We think we can't enjoy things. Listen, my wife and I got a gift card last Christmas to this steakhouse in Lexington called Malone's, if you've ever been there. And we have been waiting. And we went on Friday night. We dropped our kids off at VBS in Lexington. And I had wonderful food. And I enjoyed every bite of it. My wife had a filet mignon, and we had sweet potatoes, fries, and I got an appetizer. I mean, I had to spend all the gift card, you know, so like, we lived it up. I don't apologize for that. I thank God for this gift of food. God made that food. I went to a Yankees-Braves series at Yankee Stadium 2 weeks ago. The Braves only won one of the games, but that's okay. One win against that evil empire is enough. But I got to go to Yankee Stadium and watch the Atlanta Braves. I don't apologize for that. I thank God for that. Right? We don't deny the things of the world, but listen, but we make sure that those things never replace God or come before God. Like right now, my youngest son's baseball team is playing in a tournament. And I had several people ask me yesterday, are y'all going to be here? Are y'all going to be here? Are y'all going to be here? And you know what I said? Mm-mm. We don't play baseball on Sunday morning. We worship God on Sunday morning. Because as we enjoy the things in this world, we don't ever let those things come over here and get in the way of the one who is ultimate. Christ is ultimate. We see with our hearts. And that vision guides the eyes in our heads. And we're able to see the world rightly because of faith. Life is all about hearing and seeing. But listen to me, church. It's about selective hearing and selective seeing, because we have to fight to cultivate habits to make sure that we keep God in view and we keep His voice the prominent voice in our lives. It's not easy to do. Jesus recognized that. And I'm going to leave you with this. John 20, 29. You remember doubting Thomas? What did Thomas want? He said, I'll believe you when I can touch it. When I can see the scars. And so Jesus was gracious to Thomas, and he met him where he was, and he showed him. But what did Jesus say? Listen to this, church. Have you believed me because you have seen me? Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed. That's us. May it be us every day until He returns and we see Him with these eyes and these eyes. Let's pray.